Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
At Washington Square Park, a clash over a new curfew last night led to nearly 24 arrests.
You know, the mayor is not the police commissioner. I'm not a professional cop who knows how to handle crowd control. It's ridiculous. You hire people who can do that.
I don't know. I think the cops are being a bit too oppressive, if I'm being honest.
I ain't even trying to go nowhere near no subway with all these slashes, all this craziness I'm hearing. I think they definitely need to increase police, more police.
And I understand that you have to strive, struggle, and survive, but not with a gun.
Do you ever worry about your own personal safety?
There's just not much one can do about that. And if to live in constant fear is not to live.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Last weekend, a 10-year-old boy, Justin Wallace, was killed when a stray bullet shot through his home in Far Rockaway, Queens. The details of who fired the gun and why are still emerging, but what seems clear is that it all stems back to an argument over a shared driveway, over parking, presumably. This child lost his life just days before his 11th birthday because tempers flared over something trivial and guns were involved. Justin's death shook people. And it has come to symbolize something in New York City right now, a palpable anxiety about our safety. As millions of us joyfully flock back into the streets after a deeply traumatic year, there is also an edge to this moment. There were more shooting incidents in New York last year than in nearly 20 years. And the striking rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, which we've talked about previously on the show, it has really changed the way some New Yorkers go about their lives. One of our producers who grew up in Southeast Queens, she's been out talking to people in her part of the city about how they feel about their safety right now. And I want to share what one person said, Richard David, who's a leader in the Queens Democratic Party, because I think he pretty well captures the emotions of those who are concerned.
What's, I think, really worrying, and I think this is where the perception is increasingly matching the reality, is we know that summer months in New York City happen to be more violent than other months. And if this level of violence is here and it's not even summer, then the likelihood of it only getting higher is very real for people. And I think the sense of alarm you're hearing is because we know we're not at the worst is coming.
The worst is coming. If you've been in New York City long enough, you know there's a lot of emotion and history buried in that phrase. The bad old days when violent crime was such a big part of the city's identity and the lived experience of people here. It should be no surprise then that public safety has been at the center of the mayoral election. Every single candidate has had to answer for how they are going to make us feel safe. But also remember that this time last year, our city was an epicenter of the national uprising against police brutality. And there is still a more widespread desire for more fundamental change to how we deal with public safety than I would guess ever before. This will be perhaps the largest challenge the next mayor faces, balancing very real concerns about public safety with equally real concerns about the police force that is currently charged with keeping the public safe. We're going to think about that challenge in a couple of ways on today's show. In the second part of the show, we're going to talk to an organizer in Queens who's been trying to come up with new community-based answers to public safety for many years. And we're going to take your calls too. But first, we're going to look back at the history that haunts this moment, because a previous mayor also faced this tension between widespread fear of crime and widespread distrust of the police. And what David Dinkins experienced when he tried to solve both of those problems is instructive. The story begins in the last months of the Koch administration, just before Dinkins began running for office. Our senior editor, Christopher Wirth, takes us back to the New York City streets of the late 1980s.
So, Kai, a few weeks ago, I went out to the Lower East Side in Manhattan to find this specific spot on the sidewalk.
So, you're somewhere around here.
I met up with a woman named Tisha Pryor there. She lived in the neighborhood in the late 1980s as a college student.
If you had a GPS locator for me at that time, you would see me crisscrossing in the area all the time. I mean,
this neighborhood, as Tisha describes it, was really diverse. It was interesting. You know, Tisha is Black. And at the center of it all, this community was Tompkins Square Park.
You would see the normal folks with their things out on the sidewalk that they were selling, so it was pretty busy.
And what was at this spot on the sidewalk that you were looking for?
So one hot summer night, this was August 6th, 1988, it was a Saturday, Tisha and a friend of hers were standing on this part of the sidewalk just outside the park.
So maybe there.
And you know what you have to understand is that Tompkins Square at that time had become home to a number of homeless people, drug users, people playing loud music late at night.
Yeah.
You know, we can't go into all the details of what was happening, but suffice it to say that tension had been growing for months between people in the park and some in the surrounding community. And the city, you know, to try to clear the park out, had established a curfew for Tompkins Square. And a couple of hundred people had gathered on the street that night to try to keep the park open.
And so I, along with some other people, ended up here. And there was a huge amount of police. I was a little taken aback. There were officers on horseback that were lined up on the avenue. There was a helicopter flying above. I mean, the presence of the force definitely was giving a message that was meant to intimidate the crowd.
So how many officers were there, do you know?
Newspaper accounts, there was a total of 440.
Wow.
And, you know, as for the crowd, it's unclear exactly how big it was, but there weren't that many more protesters than police there. But there were some people throwing bottles and other debris, which made things even more tense with the police that night.
They seemed pissed.
And then, you know, as she describes it, just as that 1 a.m. curfew was about to hit, the police rushed into the crowds.
They rushed on horses and they rushed on foot.
Get inside or get away.
And then at one point, an officer pushed me and said, "Move, you Black bitch." And then I was hit on the back of my head by a police baton.
Were you bleeding after that?
I was bleeding, yeah. And I turned around because I realized that my friend wasn't with me, and I saw that he had been shoved by police, and there were a number of them surrounding him, hitting him.
Call an ambulance!
It was just total, total chaos.
This is Clayton Patterson. He's an artist and photographer who lived just down the street from Tompkins Square. He still does.
I was videotaping because I had a Panasonic AG-155, which was one of the first commercially available handheld cameras.
He filmed Tisha and dozens of other people being attacked.
If you watch the videotape, you will see some cops had no badges on.
This lady got hit in the head with a nightstick by police officers. I'm a witness. I seen it.
Cops going wild.
Now, Kai, I think, you know, as most people know, cases of police abuse are really hard to prove. But in this case, these images of Tisha and all these other people start making the news.
For the past 48 hours, video has been surfacing like this sequence, in which the police approach a demonstrator and begin first berating him, then beating and chasing him.
You know, today, of course, we know this as the Tompkins Square riot of 1988. Dozens of people were injured. There were 121 complaints filed against the NYPD. But in the end, you know, very few officers actually faced any kind of repercussions for what happened that night.
I would have hoped for some kind of true accountability, but I didn't have any illusion that there would be. Because at that time, as is still the case, the police themselves.
So just to unpack what Tisha is saying here, you know, in New York, we have what's called the Civilian Complaint Review Board, or CCRB. Mm-hmm. It was started in the 1950s. It's supposed to investigate cases of police misconduct. But the problem, you know, had been that it was controlled by the police department itself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let me ask you a question here. Out of the 73 investigators who worked for the CCRB at that time of this riot, how many of them do you think were actually civilians, meaning not police officers investigating other police officers? Do you want to just like take a guess at a number?
I'll be generous and say 10.
Your generosity is a little too much because it was 6. And the people who were coming in to report police misconduct said that they did not feel comfortable talking about what happened to them with another police officer, right?
Right.
So what evolved out of Tompkins Square were calls for more civilian oversight of the NYPD, you know, a truly civilian, independent civilian complaint review board.
And Ed Koch was our mayor at the time. Did he support anything like that?
You know, well, Koch had already made some smaller changes to the CCRB the year before. It's just that he had been very reluctant to do so. And even the chairperson of the CCRB at this time, you know, after this riot, had said it had not been enough. But there was about to be an election in New York in 1989. And just a year after that riot at Tompkins Square, someone would come along who had a very different view of policing and police misconduct than any of his predecessors.
I'm David Dinkins, and 20 days from now, I will be sworn in as the 106th mayor of the city of New York.
Coming up, the story of David Dinkins versus the NYPD. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. When David Dinkins stepped into office, he faced a similar, if far more intense, version of today's political dynamic. A lot of people were thinking about police brutality because of scenes like the one you heard before the break, the extreme force NYPD used in clearing people out of Tompkins Square Park. At the same time, lots of people in the city just didn't feel safe, and they wanted something done about a very real violent crime problem. Dinkins, New York's first and still only black mayor, he tried to confront both things. And his experience is instructive for whomever is about to become the next mayor of New York City. Our senior editor, Christopher Wirth, has been talking with former Dinkins staffers and with people who knew him and understood the obstacles he faced. Christopher starts by explaining the role policing played in the 1989 election.
Well, you know, we have to remember who Dinkins was running against in 1989.
So here is your other candidate, Rudolph Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani was this former federal prosecutor, you know, who'd taken down the mafia.
Thank you.
Who really tried to cast himself as Mr. Tough on Crime.
And yes, to the toughest crackdown on criminals this city has ever seen.
And at the time, the crime rate in New York was really spiraling out of control. I mean, breaking new records for homicides year after year. You know, we talk about this increase in crime that's happened in the city over the past year. What we're seeing today is nowhere close to what it was back then. You know, there are over 1,900 people were murdered in New York in 1989. That number was 462 last year. Mm-hmm. But Dinkins had his own plan for how to take on this problem.
With respect to crime and drugs, most people know that my plan is to double the number of community patrol officers in my first term, put a cop on every subway train every night.
His fundamental goal was community policing.
Kai, this is Michael Carfin. He worked for Dinkins when Dinkins was Manhattan Borough President in the 1980s, all the way through his time as mayor.
Communities of color basically felt like there was policing because you were black. Policing because you were Latino. And because the police force had been declining in numbers, they moved off of the sidewalks and they moved into cars. And so a lot of policing became patrol cars, like a military vehicle going through the community. And most of the police force didn't live in the city.
You know, it's interesting, Kai. This is still a point of contention today. It's come up in the mayoral debates this year. At the time we're talking about here, roughly 40% of officers lived outside the city.
They lived in Long Island. They lived in Westchester.
Today, that number is 51%.
Wow.
So you have police who don't have an affiliation or have an affinity with the community and a culture that you have to change.
I want us to get back to the days when the police officer knows the neighborhood and the people in the community knows the police officer and says to the officer, how's your wife? How's your husband, as the case may be? And the police officer, when he sees a child on the street, says, go home, Johnny, or I'll tell your mother. I mean, back to those days.
And I think that rubbed up against the established police culture from the beginning, because they were perfectly comfortable being in patrol cars, just driving around, not having to build relationships. And now you're trying to totally disrupt that. That's what he wanted to do.
So Dinkins had this idea of shaking up how the police department does its work, how it actually polices.
Yeah.
But he also wanted to make them more accountable in what they did while they were policing, right? I mean, So how did he talk about that on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it was not an issue that came up a lot in the 1989 election. But during one of the debates that year, a well-known Black journalist here in New York, Dominique Carter, he stands up and asks a question.
As mayor, what would either one of you gentlemen do to cut back on police brutality?
Well, it is a very important area. I have tried always when I have been critical of the police. And
in his answer, you know, Dinkins lists Black and brown people who'd been killed by police or died in police custody, these really high-profile events that had happened in just the recent few years before the election.
Eleanor Bumpers, Michael Stewart, Juan Rodriguez, I've spoken out at those times. But each time I tried to use great care to make the point that I believe that the vast number of women and men who make up the New York City Police Department are good, honest, hardworking people who put their lives on the line for all of us every day. Having said that, it still is important that it be understood that it is illegal to use excessive force.
Well, that sounds very cautious to the modern ear, I imagine. You know, he's being very careful there, but we have to remember that there wasn't anything like the kind of support for reform that there is today, even in Black communities, let alone outside of the Black community.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what you also have to remember is that the police unions in New York, in particular, the Police Benevolent Association or the PBA, it's still, you know, one of the most powerful unions in the city today. Historically, it did not like any of the kinds of ideas David Dinkins was talking about.
No matter how temperate they may be.
Yeah, and they have always wielded a lot of influence with whoever is mayor of New York.
The PBA certainly thinks they are a force to be reckoned with. And Dave represented absolute change.
This is Keith Wright. He also worked for Dinkins when he was Manhattan Borough President. Mm-hmm. He claims the union could be very aggressive, well past the point of politics.
Mm. Listen, I talk from personal experience.
Keith's father was Bruce Wright, a judge in the New York City Criminal Court and later in the state Supreme Court.
My father was probably one of the most famous judges in New York at that point. They called him Turnin' Loose Bruce, and the police union hated him because he would let Black and brown people out with no bail.
And some of the people he'd released were accused of assaulting police officers.
And I used to get packages, letters all the time, some with human excrement in there, saying that this is what you're going to look like if your father keeps up his anti-police stance.
So you're saying the police union used to send threats to you and your family?
All the time. Oh, hell yeah. all of that. So who are you going to take them to? You can't take them to the police because they're doing it.
I mean, has that been confirmed elsewhere that the police union actually sent threats like that?
Yeah, you know, I worked really hard to confirm this. It happened a long time ago. Keith's father, you know, passed away in 2005. I reached out to the police union, haven't received a response. But I've spoken with, you know, several people with firsthand experience of the police unions who say, you know, this would not have been out of character for the unions at the time.
Stop that! No!
And that it was still the case when Dinkins defeated Giuliani in 1989.
Quiet! Quiet! I just spoke to Mayor-elect David Dinkins on the telephone. I've congratulated him. It's an historic event. He'll be the first. Listen.
I see the decade of the 1990s as a time when we move away from selfishness and privilege to a time of community and inclusion.
You know, Dinkins came into office with this vision for what the city could be.
Right.
A new urban agenda, an agenda that recognizes government as a tool for good.
But as Michael Carfin describes it, Dinkins had inherited some really huge problems.
We came into office in January 1st of 1990. The city had a $1 billion hole in its budget that Koch had not fixed. We were in a recession. And, you know, the crime rate was alarming.
A few months after becoming mayor, David Dinkins today was confronted with one of the most heinous crimes ever perpetrated in New York City.
The murder rate was reaching new records.
The mayor told us it was the worst moment in his public career. Going inside, seeing the bodies, he said.
And so, you know, in a move that you would think would appeal to the police unions, Dinkins sets about hiring thousands of new officers, you know, around 6,000 total new uniformed police officers.
In the middle of while he's dealing with this massive budget deficit.
Yes, yes. I mean, at the time, it was described as the biggest restructuring of the NYPD in the city's history. And it was the thing that was going to allow Dinkins to do what he talked about in his campaign, you know, to get police out into communities, actually getting to know the people they're supposed to serve. That was his ideal.
We will seek to cure the disease, not to curse the afflicted. And we will push back the frontiers of fear to take back our streets and our parks from the pushers, the muggers, and the murderers.
But the other thing he does, and, you know, we're really fast-forwarding through time here, is he starts hammering out a plan with the city council to fix the problem, you know, we identified at the top of the show with Tompkins Square, which is that the police were essentially policing themselves. You know, the Civilian Complaint Review Board was under the control of the police department. Right. Dinkins wanted legislation to create a truly civilian agency that, in his view, could start to strike the kind of balance you were talking about earlier, you know, between police power and community distrust.
I feel strongly that a fully independent civilian complaint board empowered with the means to reach impartial decisions will serve to mend such rifts.
He believed that we in public service were accountable, and that included the police. There weren't exceptions to that because they were public servants. They had tough jobs, but a lot of people had tough jobs. And sometimes they made mistakes. Well, they needed to be held accountable for that because they also had power. And that's why he believed so much in that Civilian Complaint Review Board.
Such an impartial mechanism becomes not only a natural component of the community policing model, but will serve to instill greater community confidence in the neighborhood cop.
So you mentioned how the police unions had always fought every mayor ever on any type of reform.
Yeah.
How did they respond to Dinkins?
So late in the summer of 1992, the Police Benevolent Association, or the PBA, began organizing a protest of their own. And they were going to do it right outside Dinkins' doorstep.
So they were trying to get as many officers as possible to take off and come down for this rally at City Hall.
Kai, this is Mark Claxton. He's been on the show before. He's a former NYPD detective. He's an outspoken critic of the NYPD. At the time, he was an active duty cop.
And quite frankly, the blacks on the jobs were like, nope, we're not participating in that. You know, we pay our union dues. We're in the union, but we're not coming down to your demonstration.
Do you recall how the day began?
The job that I had, when there were disturbances, the police desk in City Hall would call me.
Carfin, you know, by this point, he was working as Dinkins' community director. On September 16th, 1992, it was a Wednesday, he gets the word that thousands of off-duty police officers had stormed onto the steps of City Hall protesting David Dinkins.
They barged onto the plaza, and then I just filled the plaza.
They ended up knocking over barricades, disrespecting the on-duty police officers who were there.
You know, these police officers, there were 10,000 of them there.
Wow.
They push past the officers who were supposed to be guarding City Hall. They were jumping on cars parked around the building. They were carrying placards. One read, "Dinkins must go." Someone had a very offensive caricature of Dinkins with an afro and large lips.
Good grief.
Another sign, you know, called him, quote, a washroom attendant.
So I'm like inside the building at City Hall, looking out at this sea of pretty much all white faces screaming and chanting and using the N-word constantly.
The white officers hated Dave Dinkins. I mean, they would be frothing at the mouth. And the two blacks that I know that were down there, they were most shocked by the open, vile, racist language being thrown around by guys that, you know, just a couple hours before that, they were working in squad cars together.
Are you going to get some street opinions over here or what?
Sure.
Hey, I think it sucks.
It was more about the fact that some people were uncomfortable, especially the unions were very uncomfortable with the black mayor.
I mean, this is not a rally, Christopher. It doesn't sound like to me. What this sounds like is a riot, like a literal riot by the New York Police Department against the mayor of New York.
Yeah. At one point, they blocked traffic and took over the Brooklyn Bridge. And the man who was there firing them up on stage with Phil Caruso, you know, the police union boss, was the man Dinkins had beat in the election.
The mayor doesn't know why the morale of the New York City Police Department is so low.
Rudy Giuliani.
He blames it on me. He blames it on you. The reason the morale of the police department of the city of New York is so low is one reason and one reason alone. David Dinkins!
I was probably a predecessor of what happened on January 6th at the United States Capitol.
This, again, is Keith Wright.
And the PBA, I mean, they felt as if they could do whatever it is that they did and say whatever it is they wanted to say with impunity.
So how did Dinkins respond to this violent show of force?
Yeah, you know, Dinkins had this reputation as kind of a true gentleman, very statesmanlike in public. And that was true, you know, but this incident made him very angry.
Let's assume this is the worst legislation known to man. It is still no excuse for the behavior that at least the reports I've gotten of how they behaved out there today. And I say that Phil Caruso and the leadership of the PBA is responsible, and for Rudy Giuliani to urge them on, as it were, it demonstrates an irresponsibility on his behalf.
He didn't pretend to be anything other than pissed. I mean, it was something that really got under his skin.
Kai, this is Barbara Turk. She helped run Dinkins' Office of Management and Budget. She remembers leaving work that day, walking past City Hall where the police had been.
On my way home that night, I actually was stopped by a guy who pretended to have a gun in his jacket. You know, he had his hand stuck in there, and he told me to empty my wallet. So I did. I was about a block and a half from my home. And so I decided to call the precinct. And the next thing that happened is that I had two police officers sitting in my living room on the couch, taking my statement and petting my cat. It was a man and a woman. They were both white. And the woman had long red fingernails. And they asked me at some point, you know, where do you work? And I said, oh, I work downtown near City Hall. And they said, oh, did you see us down there today? And they were very excited about what they had done. And it was a very, very uncomfortable circumstance to have these two police officers in my apartment. It's what I sometimes now refer to as, you know, white people enlisting me to be a white person with them. Meaning they just assumed that I would think it was the coolest thing. And I have a certain amount of guilt, maybe even shame, that I didn't tell them who I worked for. But I didn't feel safe to do that because I knew things were very tense between the mayor and the police department. And I was afraid of them.
It's not acceptable to be a bigot. It's not acceptable to be a racist.
So, Christopher, what about Dinkins' plans for the Civilian Complaint Review Board? Did he ever get the reforms he wanted?
You know, for the most part, yes. Soon after that riot, Dinkins and the city council created an all-civilian CCRB. Mm-hmm. It's essentially the CCRB that we have today. And in many ways, police behavior that day sparked even more impetus among lawmakers to get that done. Mm-hmm. But to be sure, the critics still say the agency has its flaws. I mean, for example, the police commissioner still has final say over whether officers are disciplined. And in serious cases, they really rarely are.
Right. So that's as far as Dinkins was able to push this reform ball. But Christopher, what lessons do we draw from all of this, from, you know, his experience with the police union, but also just in trying to reform NYPD in general?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, the police union still wields a lot of power, political power in New York. And that's true in many other cities. I mean, take Mayor de Blasio. Yep. Promised big reforms as a candidate, but he backed down when hundreds of police officers turned their backs on him at a police funeral in 2014.
Literally turned their backs on him.
Yeah, and that visible show of force was organized by the PBA, the Police Benevolent Association. You know, the unions openly declared war on de Blasio. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, this greater scrutiny that we've seen on police in recent years has also come with a greater scrutiny on the role that the unions play in opposing police reform.
They only have the power that was given to them by legislators, by the elected officials. That's it.
You know, each of the serious mayoral candidates this year are promising some degree of police reform, some more than others. And Mark Claxton says that what the union will do is challenge that new mayor's authority, like it did to Dinkins, like it did to de Blasio, and that whether they succeed depends on whether they're willing to stand up to the union.
Politicians are still afraid of the PBA. They still think that the PBA have more actual voting power than they do.
Christopher, thank you for sharing all of this reporting with us.
Yeah, thank you, Kai.
Coming up, we resume the conversation we've been having about how we want our next mayor to both manage public safety and end police brutality and corruption. We'll visit a Queens neighborhood that has seen a lot of gun violence lately, and we'll take your calls. New Yorkers, do you feel safe right now? Why or why not? And how big a deal is public safety for you as a voter? 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll take your calls after the break. Hey, a quick program note. In both politics and news, it's depressing to see how quickly people can just move on from something. As if just because we all talked about a problem as the lead news story for a few months, that's enough, regardless of whether anything's actually been done about it. It feels like that's happened with police reform. So on this show, we're trying to keep policing and criminal justice reform on the front burner, finding new and hopefully interesting ways to keep that conversation going. And as part of that effort, we've created a page on our website where we've gathered some of our episodes on policing. You'll find a pretty eclectic mix there, more histories like the one you just heard, some investigative work, conversations with former and active duty officers, and intimate stories about young people in particular. So just go to wnyc.org/anxiety and look for the collections tab. You'll see the policing collection right there underneath it. Check it out. And if you like what you see, I hope you will also share it with somebody. Thanks for listening. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We're going to come back to the present now and to the mayoral election that is officially underway. Voting started in the Democratic primary yesterday. The winner of that race is almost certainly going to be the next mayor of New York. And whomever that is will face a challenge similar to the one that David Deakins confronted, balancing concerns about public safety with concerns about the police force tasked with keeping the public safe. So we want to hear from you. We've asked a couple of times in previous shows about police reform, but tonight I just want to know, are you feeling safe right now? Why or why not? We've already put this question to some people out on the streets of Southeast Queens. That's an area of the city that's more than a dozen distinct neighborhoods. And there have been a few high-profile gun incidents there. And one of our producers, Carolyn Adams, she lives there and grew up there. So she went out to get a pulse of what her neighbors are feeling. Here's some of what she heard.
I'm from Queens, Ozone Park.
Hollis, Queens.
I've been working in Woodsdale for over 25 years.
I'm a district leader in South Ozone Park and Springfield Garden.
I feel safer now than I did before COVID, to be honest with you, because people were wild and free, you know what I mean?
I've been living in Queens for maybe like the last 35 years, homeowner, and it's scary.
Since after Floyd, everything's a little cooled down because, you know, the country was too hot.
I feel safe wherever I go. I'm a New York City kid, and I came up with age at a time when it was the height of the crack epidemic. It's never been as bad as that.
There's no week that goes by, it seems, in Southeast Queens that there is a stray bullet incident. So it's not that abnormal. People are very worried.
I, like a lot of folks in this area, sometimes you don't pay close attention to it until and unless it hits you in your household or in your community.
We don't need more police. We just need more social services to really help the people around here.
We can't be calling 311. We can't be calling 911. As men and women in our community on our blocks, we gotta establish order. If we are voting somebody in office, then we gotta hold them accountable to do their job. They gotta go get them racist police out these police precincts.
That last voice you heard was Erica Ford, a Jamaica Queens native, who is the founder and executive director of Life Camp. It's a violence prevention program that Erica started back in 2008. And Erica joins me now to help take your calls about whether you're feeling safe and what can be done about it.
Thank you for having me. And I just want to correct you on one thing, that Life Camp was started in 2002.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said the wrong thing. 2002 is what it says on my page. So sometimes my mouth does its own thing, Erica.
We know about that. We know. It's a lot going on.
Well, speaking of a lot going on, is it my understanding that you are, even as we were preparing for this show, responding to a shooting incident?
Yes, our team was responding to shooting incidents right before this call, or right at the time of the call. Yeah.
Shots fired.
So nobody got shot as of right now. There's no...
How would you portray, just characterize how where we're at right now? And I mean, you've been doing this work for decades. This feeling that there's more gun violence right now than there's been in a long time. How would you portray where we're at?
So 1993, there was 5,269 shooting incidents. 2017, there was 789 incidents. 2020, it went up again to 1,531 incidents, right? And in 2017, also to take note, it was 290 killings, the lowest it's been in 25 years. We made New York the safest big city in America. We took it from that 5,269 to 789 incidents and 290 people who were killed, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. What we do works. And so when you talk about the person that is going to win is going to go into a similar situation of Dinkins. The fundamental difference that that new mayor has is the Office to Prevent Gun Violence and the New York City Crisis Management System. What we do works.
So what is that that we do? When you say what we do works, help, what is it? What is that?
And so what we do is we help prepare community and prevent shooting incidents. We help intervene and mitigate incidents. We help heal and recover. We respond to shooting incidents like we just did, right? And so what it comes from is violence interrupters who work with those who have the highest potential to shoot someone or be shot. Because we know most of these incidents that are happening, of course, there's 8 million people in the city. And so when we look at it, it's around, what, 1% of, not even 1% of the people who are involved and who are leading the incidents, right? And so across New York City, there is this thing, this started in 2012 with five sites, $5 million. It has expanded to 30-something sites and $53 million, 40-something, $53 million. And we provide jobs, both workforce training and real jobs during the work year and during the summer. We provide mentorship and work with individuals in the prison, in Rikers, in ACS, close to home facilities. We provide direct services on the ground at the hospitals when incidents happen to prevent retaliation. We work with the young people in the hotspot areas and give them different tools and resources to change the behavioral norms in those areas so that they look at resolving their historical trauma with healing tools rather than guns. Because one thing we are sure is that when the shooting incidents through the decades even declined and reduced, the economic improvement in those communities didn't. The poverty didn't. So when you look at where coronavirus hit and where was the epicenter in Southeast Queens and other areas, that it was the area that the precondition that we suffer from is poverty. So there's lack of, like the video, the tape that y'all heard me screaming so eloquently, or I should say not, but there are police in our community who don't work together with us, right? Stop and frisk cause trauma in our areas. The crack.
But let me ask you, Erica. So, because in that tape, you say we shouldn't be calling 311 and 911. We got to handle this ourselves. So, what does that mean? What is the role of police in the model that you just laid out? Where do the police fit in it or not?
I don't know the content of that conversation. That is a piece of me speaking. I don't know what the whole conversation was, but what I can say, right? Not in relationship to that clip, because I don't know what the clip was attached to, right? That the people in community have to work to resolve incidents amongst community. We have to, because it is us that live with us. It is our children. It is in our household. It is the men and women of community that we train to be interrupters. We train to be credible clinicians and credible messengers in the community to help work with these young people who are in trauma, right? We cannot separate what is happening, right? We can't act like, oh, there's just some people shooting for no reason at all, right? The shooting incidents happen in areas where there is no resources, like I heard some of the people say on your video.
I was just going to say that the speech we played there, that was at Juneteenth celebration and rally last year. That was the context of that, just so folks know and you know. And I want to ask you, Erica, because I started the show talking about Justin Wallace, the 10-year-old boy who was killed by a stray bullet in Far Rockaway last weekend. which wasn't the first stray bullet incident lately. What's your sense of just where the community is at around that event? I mean, it just feels like it's been such a big deal in so many of our consciousness.
Yeah, I think the incidents of these stray bullets, well, you talked about it. You said it was over the driveway, right? And so I would take that situation, right? You have a lot of people in rage, right? People were locked in their houses for a year. People lost their jobs. People lost their loved ones. People couldn't grieve with family members who they lost. People couldn't connect to the people who they lost. People were living large families in small environments and couldn't get to where, you know, to access space to just breathe. They didn't have, when you're living in housing developments, when you're living in these closed, captured areas, you don't have big backyards. You don't have access to the parks because the rims were taken down. You couldn't go outside. You couldn't congregate here. And so people could not release. They're inside on video games. The dopamine is building up. Everything is building up, and there's nowhere to release. And so we have to put things in contextual reality. That when you look at the lack of resources in community, then you get situations that are uncontrollable. In March of last year, we went to the mayor and the city and said, these are the things that we need to do. We need to double, triple, because if you talked about in the beginning of your show also that the summer was coming with Mark Claxton, the summer is coming, it's the most dangerous time, right? And so since you know it's the most dangerous time, when you know these situations are happening, when you know people are confined and need to release, and so how do you then prepare for peace, right? Yeah. How do you invest in peace? Not police, but invest in peace, right? And so that means you have to give access to healing tools. You have to give access to space to allow people to have the freedom to breathe and live.
Jenny in Yorkville, Manhattan. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just want to say that there's a direct through line here in our city from George Floyd to January 6th, because there is a discernible notice of the police here standing down, meaning when they heard on January 6th and prior to that, stand back, stand down, that was a message to them to back up, don't go on as many calls, don't just sort of hold off on your job. There has been a major notice of that. When that guy opened fire in Times Square, their office is in Times Square on 43rd Street, and they're supposed to be on 46th Street, the SWAT teams, in their cars. There's no reason that that shouldn't have gotten handled right away.
Let me put that to you, Erica. We constantly struggle with this, this idea that, you know, if you criticize NYPD, they pull back, and if you don't, then they do too much. I mean, but I hear you talking about a model that is about neither nor, that isn't about whether or not NYPD, what they are doing one way or the other. How do you think about that?
I think that we have to co-produce public safety. I think the police exist in our community right now. And right now, they need to do their job in a manner that is of empathy and compassion to our community. That when they show up in Bayside, when they show up in Upper West Side, when they show up in Howard Beach, it's not the same way they show up in our community. So what we are saying is that they need to do their job. The other thing that we're saying is that they have too much money in policing. Everything can't be done with a hammer. You can't fix all problems with criminal locking people up and you can't arrest your way out of it. You can't criminalize your way out of it, right? And so therefore, you have to invest in community-based resolutions. You have to invest in the people being able to deal with the issues in their community. When the 14-year-old boy got shot and killed on a basketball court in Baisley Projects, the police were standing right there on the basketball court, and there was a police tower on the corner. But what was not there was a community center where he could have been playing inside. It was closed. The PAL, where he could have been playing basketball inside, it was closed. And so if we invest in our community and giving people the proper resources and equity in our community and equity in policing, then we will see a difference.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. A special thanks this week to Alexis Gordon, who helped collect our interviews with people on the streets of Southeast Queens. Hannes Brown mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Carl Boisrond, Emily Botine, Karen Frohman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Verlyn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at @Kai_Wright. And of course, I hope you will join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.